guys.
How's everybody doing?
This is Back Row Super Show.
Right.
This is the main show where we dive into a topic and kind of talk about all the things that we liked about it. This was my selection. This episode will be what?
Who are you?
I'm Zach.
And I'm Stuart.
Yes, thank you for reminding me. It's been a while since we've recorded, so...
Yeah, to let people know who we are and whatnot. So, what's our topic for today?
Our topic is The Shining, the film, or Stanley Kubrick is the real monster.
Yeah.
I guess there's a content warning a little bit before this one. I don't think we're going to put up two episodes like we did for Rosemary's Baby.
No.
Specifically because there's nothing as traumatizing about this movie like there is in the integrity of the work itself as there is in Rosemary's Baby.
Right. I mean, this is a horror sort of thriller movie.
Right. But I mean, I did want to put in a content warning for some of the stuff I'll talk about in the history section because... There's Stanley Kubrick was not great to Shelley Duvall on the cast behind the scenes of this. So while there's no assault like with Roman Polanski, there is evidence that he was, purposefully dismissive of her behind the scenes.
Right.
Went out of his way to kind of be a huge dick to her. But there's also an argument that he was doing it purposefully because he was trying to get a performance out of the actress as if she were a wife that has to deal with a husband like that.
Yeah.
My thinking is there's a thing called acting. You should let your actors do the acting and not actually terrorize them on set.
Right. And I mean, Stanley Kubrick did this for all of his films, pretty much, where he would torment his actors
to get a
certain reaction that he wanted.
Yeah, he's kind of obsessive, but we'll get into that later.
We'll get into that. Also, I am wearing some overalls, some little kid overalls, and I've got my trike right behind me.
Oh, good.
So I can ride around in the...
Well, let me know if you see any dead naked ladies.
I will, or dead twins.
Yeah. So, the history section of this movie came out in 1980. It was filmed for $19 million and the total box office was $44.4 million.
Okay, that's a nice return.
It is a nice return. It honestly, I think that this movie does not look like it was shot for just $19 million.
Yeah.
I think it's very well put together, but it's also a Kubrick movie.
Yeah. So the cinematography is fantastic.
Yeah, cinematography is fantastic. I have a little story about that in a little bit, but I kind of wanted to go historically through the context of it.
Yeah.
When casting the movie, so Jack Nicholson was Kubrick's first choice.
And he did a stellar performance.
The studio, so first of all, Stephen King, the author, this is an adaptation of his book,
right?
Was very disappointed in this casting choice.
Really?
So De Niro, Robin Williams, and Harrison Ford were all considered in earlier casting sessions.
Wow, that would be weird to see Robin Williams in this.
Because of the studio, yeah.
Yeah, that would have been such a different movie.
It would. King disliked Nicholson as a representation of Jack Torrance.
Okay.
He suggested an everyman like a John Voight or a Christopher Reeve or Michael Moriarty. In my notes, I have WTF next to Michael Moriarty because he's kind of a TV actor. He's in a movie called Q, The Winged Serpent.
I don't know who this guy is.
He's off the walls as an actor. He just looks like a guy, though. Like, he's not very memorable.
Yeah.
King also criticized Shelley Duvall's performance in it.
Really?
So he says that she's basically on camera to be stupid or scream, and that's not the character I wrote about.
Now, I will say that we've both read the book, too.
Yes, it will be a book club book in the next couple of weeks. So we'll go into that a little bit more there.
Yeah, so we both do have a frame of reference of Stephen King's The Shining book.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I would, just on a surface level, I think I kind of agree with his assessment.
Really?
I think the character in the book is a little bit more of a stronger character than Shelley Duvall's performance, but she was also tormented to the point of her hair falling out.
Yeah.
To that point on the set.
I think, yeah, there were a lot of circumstances in the actual movie, and it was also kind of written that way in the movie. Like, there wasn't that many scenes where she could sort of present herself in this way that Stephen King wanted.
Yeah.
I think that had a lot to do with, like, the actual writing and script of this movie.
Yeah. Well, and I realize what I'm about to say makes it sound like I really don't like Kubrick. I have a box set of his movies. I think he is a fantastic director.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, yes, his treatment of Shelley Duvall was horrible and atrocious.
Yes.
I think that the problem mainly lies with, because he was treating her like that offset,
mm-hmm.
the way he normally makes movies, I've noticed, is, and lots of people have noticed, because I've read this opinion written elsewhere.
Yeah.
Is that he tends to kind of treat characters as if he is an alien or a scientist, and he's observing how these characters interact.
Yeah.
Like, you can see that in Full Metal Jacket, in Eyes Wide Shut, Lolita especially.
Yeah.
And Dr. Strangelove, which, you know, I don't know if you've seen it, but that's also fantastic.
I have. Now, a question for you, Zach. Since you've seen all of the Stanley Kubrick movies, do you think this is one of his stronger films? Do you think that this is one of his better ones?
I do feel like it's one of his better ones.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's the best?
No. Okay. I think that 2000, just in terms of what he was able to bring to the technique and technology of making a film.
Yeah.
I think I gotta side with, like, pretty much anyone who writes about Kubrick in saying that 2001 mm-hmm. is probably his best work as a director.
Okay. Now, do you think it was because of the constraints of making a movie out of a book? Like, he had to follow a certain script. He couldn't really...
Well, no. So, and the reason I say that is a lot of his... pretty much everything he's known for is adapted from a book.
It's true.
2001, Lolita, obviously, adapted from a book. 2001 is adapted from a book. I don't know the history there. I think Arthur C. Clarke was writing the script and novelized the script so that the book came out first and then the movie, but they were made side by side.
What about Clockwork Orange?
That's based on a book.
Oh.
Yeah, that is based on a book. Full Metal Jacket, probably, I don't know if it's based on a book, but I think it's drawn from essays and stuff from Vietnam vets.
Yeah.
Probably a lot from Tim O'Brien.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God. Yeah, the things that they carried. And,
yeah.
Yeah. I can't
It's funny,
that.
I've never met another person who's ever heard of that book.
That's really?
Awesome. Yeah, I know it's a bestseller, but like I've never met anyone else who's read that book.
Well,
it's fantastic.
It is. It was actually a book that we had to read in high school.
Yeah, we did
so,
too.
So, yeah, it was like a required reading, so.
Yeah. And then Eyes Wide Shut was based on, I'm going to screw up the French, but it's Trom Novelle. It's either a book or a short story written by a French author, I think, in the 20s or 30s.
Huh. I did not know any of this.
So all of his stuff was actually adapted. Actually, so there's a story that he, whenever he was looking for a property to adapt in mm-hmm. his later career, his wife would say, would like hear him, and or he would be in another room, and he'd be reading, and when he gets to a point where he doesn't agree with the direction of the story, she said she could hear him throw the book across the room. And in her the back of her mind, she was like, well, that one's not getting adapted.
Yeah.
And The Shining is something he read and actually was really excited to adapt and change, even though it's very different.
Yeah. So I wonder, did he reach out to Stephen King, or was
I don't know the particulars there. I would assume that he reached out to Stephen King to have Warner Brothers buy the rights, because he worked very closely with Warner Brothers for most of his large career.
Yeah.
This movie, the way it's shot, the cinematography, he's fantastic. I think because he started his career as a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was always very much into the workings of the camera, what you could get out of the film and the lens and all of that.
Yeah.
The Steadicam is used extensively in this. Anyone who doesn't know, the Steadicam at this time was basically, there was a rig that the cameraman would wear. And there was a gyro in it that keeps the camera level. So you could do tracking shots, which is when the camera is moving through a scene.
Yeah.
Without having movement from the cameraman walking. And also it means that to do moving shots where everything is still, you don't need a dolly or a track.
Yeah.
That the camera's being pushed on.
And you could do extended scenes without having a cut.
Yes,
without,
exactly.
You know, cutting to a different view or something along those lines. Yeah, and there are plenty of those scenes in this movie.
Yeah. The camera operator in this movie is actually the guy that invented the Steadicam.
Oh, nice.
And the way Kubrick got him to work on the movie was basically blackmail. He apparently saw something else that the guy had done.
Yeah.
Called him up and said, hey, or wrote him a letter, I think, and said, hey, I'm working on this movie. I would love to have you bring your Steadicam and actually operate the camera on this film. If you don't, though, just to be up front, I have seen behind the scenes photograph of you filming, and I think that I can reverse engineer your rig from the shadow on the wall. Because, jeez. Again, Kubrick was a tech head. Like, yeah. He knew how all of these pieces fit together. So he basically threatened him and said, I can reverse engineer your shit and figure out how to make it. So you can either come work for me, or I'll just do it anyway.
Yeah. Why not do it and get paid?
Yeah, and I think that guy's name is George Merritt. But so the sets of this movie, all of the interiors were actually constructed at EMI Elm Street Studios, making the which worked on a number of levels. Kubrick was deathly afraid of flying, so he made England his home after New York got too cramped, I guess, or wasn't working for him, and so he moved to England, where I think he lived the rest of his life.
Yeah.
I mean, he was such a control freak that he had a big film editing lab on site.
Oh, wow.
And an archive of all of his film reels.
So he could control
what the saturation levels on the film are.
Yeah.
Sorry if this is getting a little bit too in the weeds. I'm not myself a filmmaker, so
these
are the things that compose the film, and Kubrick is such a tech head and knows how to work with film and expose it at different levels because he's a photographer.
Yeah.
He can influence what the movie looks like.
Yeah. And we could do a whole cast on just Stanley Kubrick, and it would probably be hours upon hours.
Yeah. I mean, so one of the things in this is that he, everyone says that the movie looks cold and chilly.
Mm-hmm.
All of these scenes were shot on a set. The reason that a lot of people feel that way is if you watch the film, the films in the interiors of the hotel all have a higher level of blue gel saturation, and nice. So there's this subconscious, oh, it's cold.
It's, yeah.
going on. But because the interiors were constructed on a set, he could do things like make the overlook in the film, he could shuffle around the floor plan so that it's impossible. So, like...
Oh, so it's impossible spacing where... Yeah.
Exactly. So, like, there's a documentary called Room 237 that dives way down the rabbit hole in trying to make the argument that he also faked the moon landing and all the clues he sprinkled through it. Mm.
Strange.
Yeah.
I've never seen that documentary.
So in the... it's on Netflix, I think. Huh. So, yeah, you can check it out. It's interesting, but it's a bunch of nut jobs talking. Now, that's dismissive. There's a lot of research that went into it, I'm sure. But
yeah.
Still. But yeah, like, so in the opening scene where Jack Torrance is having his job interview.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed, on the wall behind Ullman, there's a window.
Yeah.
His office is in the middle of the floor plan. There's nothing. That window wouldn't look out on anything.
Ah. Interesting.
The floor plans of the hotel where the rooms are, where Jack's set up to be writing in the Great Hall. Like, none of that, if you follow the characters, it would not connect.
Interesting.
There's also interesting things that he does, I think, with the subtitles depicting time.
Oh.
Where... it's constantly, like, and you don't notice it at first, but it throws your perception out of balance because he never stays with the same format.
Yeah.
Like, it'll say, you know, last day of the season, and then it'll say October 31st, and then it'll say Tuesday, and then it'll say 2 weeks later. Like, those aren't exact examples, but, like... It's a random way of describing it, and Kubrick is such a notoriously obsessive director that is not a mistake.
Yeah, that's intentional.
That is 100% intentional, like, to the point that Dr. Strangelove, have you ever seen that?
Yes.
So, the world leaders in Dr. Strangelove, or the government heads in Dr. Strangelove, are all talking around a giant circular table.
Mm-hmm.
And on the table is felt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kubrick insisted on a certain shade of green for that felt to evoke the look of a card table because they're all gambling.
Black and
exactly. White. Keep saying it. It's a black and white movie. That movie was shot in black and white. There's no color section in it.
So
that's how obsessive he is. So these intertitles are 100% intentional.
Yeah. But that's interesting about the impossible space because you get to the whole hotel being its own entity. Being
like shifting
an entity of madness.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the principal photography for this movie...
Mm-hmm.
You know what principal photography is, right? Yes. It's the actual shooting of the film.
Yeah, but you can explain it to our listeners who may not know.
Well, no. Principal photography is just when the bulk of the movie is shot. Do you know how long the average movie takes to shoot big budget like this for a studio?
Probably around, 7 months. 8 months?
No, actually much less than that. So the average time is between 45 and 90 days.
Really?
So yeah, you're working at about 3 months at the most, right?
Interesting. Yeah.
I think Marvel movies take a little bit longer.
Maybe that's what I was thinking.
Bigger ones with lots of CG, but at this time...
I was thinking of Star Wars, too. Star Wars took quite a few
months. Yeah, because you're working with a lot of different factors with that.
Like, big name actors and stuff.
Yeah.
And actresses.
But yeah, like in 1980, like the average time was about, you know, between 1 and 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Principal photography on this movie was a year.
Jeez, wow.
Mainly it's because Kubrick was an asshole.
Yeah, I mean, I assume that he probably just nitpicked little things and
So Duvall and Kubrick obviously did not get along. They argued constantly.
Yeah.
Kubrick was constantly rewriting scenes to the point that Jack Nicholson would throw his copies of the script away because there was no point in learning the lines.
Yeah.
And because they would change so frequently, so he would literally learn his lines minutes before a take.
Wow. I mean, it gives props to Jack Nicholson as a fantastic
actor. Oh, he's a fantastic actor. Yeah. There's a documentary on the behind the scenes, and I know I'm making it sound like shooting this movie was hell. I'm sure it was.
I'm sure it was hell, though. Yeah.
I don't know how much of that is also kind of circulated to form a legend around how much of an asshole he is, because, like, no doubt he did do monstrous things, but there's a documentary on the alternate disc of The Shining that I have, and it's shot by Kubrick's daughter.
Oh,
and so there's a scene where that she's like going around to the actors, talking with them. Jack Nicholson, grossly, is kind of hitting on the 17-year-old and mugging for the camera and everything. And this is while they're shooting, and they're just messing around. And then the time comes for him to get called to set and actually do the take.
Yeah, perform.
And he, like, to get into the character, like, she has the camera on him, and he's, like, running in place and, like, mumbling to himself.
Yeah.
And, like getting in the headspace.
He's getting hyped. Crazy. Yeah, getting into that space.
Yeah, and I mean, you can see clips of it online where he's, like, when he's got the axe in that scene where he's, like, swinging it over his shoulder and like hyping himself up.
Nice.
So
you want to get into the actual movie now?
No, I have more history. I have more history. Just a little bit more. So the all work and no play scene.
Yes.
Was shot over and over with different languages and equivalent idioms substituted on those.
Huh. And on different language page, on the page.
On the page that's typed out, the all work and no play make Jack a dull boy.
So different languages, like in Spanish and in
Italian, Japanese, all of that.
Even
right?
With different characters.
Yes.
Ooh, that's kind of weird. So
with different idioms.
Yeah.
Rather than, say, doing that with a few pieces of paper and then putting them on a giant stack of blank paper.
Oh, yeah.
some PA had to type out all of these because, again, Kubrick is an asshole.
Yeah.
So there are sheaves of paper 2 or 3 inches thick, and all of them have the same thing written on them.
I wonder what happened to those sheets.
Thrown away, burned.
Maybe.
Actually, the set caught fire.
Ooh. I didn't know that.
The way they lit some of the scenes when they're inside to kind of create that snowblind effect.
Yeah.
Is they had these giant Klieg lights that were on the other side of the wall to throw up lots of light on the through the windows. One of them actually caught fire to the side. So maybe they burned up.
Yeah.
The scene where Nicholson is told to chop down is chopping down the door is Torrance. So originally he had to chop down a prop door.
Okay.
Side note, he used to work as a volunteer fireman.
Okay, so he knows how to do
So he knows how to do it. He did it in about 10 seconds.
Dang.
So he's actually chopping through a real, like, mahogany door that they set in there, which is pretty fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, and he was pretty fit for his age, so.
Yeah, he was. It's fascinating to me watching that because there are these little scenes where the tracking shot follows him, his swing back, and it builds up.
Yeah.
And then it moves with the axe and stops abruptly.
Ah, gosh, yeah.
It's so good. The cinematography in this
is so good.
The cinematography
is fantastic, yeah.
That Here's Johnny line was an improvised line.
Yeah.
Kubrick almost cut that out and used a different line. He was living in England, so he did not recognize the significance of it.
Oh.
So he just didn't know he was referencing.
Yeah.
So it was, like I said, one of the first films to use Steadicam.
Mm-hmm.
Although Kubrick modified it so that they could get sound more smoothly.
Yeah.
So, like, when Danny is riding his tricycle through the halls, you know, he goes on carpet, and then he goes on hardwood, and then...
And you can actually hear the sound of, like, the trike going onto carpet and then hardwood and then changing,
Right, yeah. So none of that was ADR'd, which ADR is when you record something and then go back and add it later.
Yeah.
Kubrick actually had the Steadicam rig modified so you could pick up stuff with, with mics that are mounted on
it. Yeah, because a lot of times it's used for, like, footsteps. Somebody will go and, like, actually walk on some tile and stuff and they'll add it into the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, 25 minutes of this movie were cut from the European release. I've never seen the European release.
Neither have I.
I don't know what 25 minutes would be cut.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers apparently felt that the film was too ambiguous and unwatchable.
Really?
Yeah.
They
did not expect good things from this movie when they got the final cut.
Yeah, but I guess they just sunk enough money into it. They were like, we've got to release it, so...
Yeah. Well, so you were asking me earlier which one I liked. What do you think Kubrick's best movie is?
Gosh, I really like The Shining, but The Shining was one of my first movies that I saw that Stanley Kubrick did. I actually saw The Shining when I was 7. I was very young.
Same.
And I remember it did dramatize me. I couldn't go to sleep that night because I was so scared. But I wasn't sure what I was scared of.
Yeah, it's just this general sense of unease.
Yeah, and that's exactly what the movie does. It gives you this, like, weird sense of unease where you're not sure what's happening with Danny. You're not sure what's happening with Jack. You're not just sure what's happening with the whole hotel. That's definitely up there, but I will say that, like, given cinematography or direction, 2001 A Space Odyssey is probably
my
favorite one. Yeah.
So, this film is widely considered as Kubrick's worst film.
Really?
I disagree.
I disagree, too.
If you ever get a chance to see this...
Who says that?
Oh, I'll get to that.
Oh, okay.
So, if you ever get the chance to see this in theaters...
Oh.
Go see it. I have seen it... My wife and I went to the Plaza around the corner.
Nice.
It was back when Warner Brothers was digitizing all their films, so they were recalling all of their film stock that was out. So it was like the last time it was being showed, that particular reel was being shown as a film reel.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. I don't know how many times I've seen this movie. It doesn't do it justice to watch it on a home television.
Yeah.
The opening scene where he's...
It's just amazing of him driving.
Driving?
Yeah.
There's such a sense of isolation and...
Exactly. And
just this undercurrent of unease that builds.
Because I also saw it on film at the Fox when they showed it.
Oh,
and it was amazing seeing it over at the Fox. Watching it in theaters gives it a certain sense of grandeur that I don't think that you can really get from watching it at home.
Well, and I also think the unease is... I have a Blu-ray, like I said, Blu-ray box set of these movies.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of wish that... Because my first version of it was on VHS.
Ah.
Seeing it on film, like, it was a film stock from probably the 80s that I saw. So everything was a little bit blurry. Like, it wasn't crisp.
Yeah.
I think having the blur in there kind of heightens the feeling of it.
It does,
like,
because
it feels real rather than something that has been remastered and made sharper. And
And again, my first viewing of this movie was on a VHS as well.
Yeah.
And it kind of gives that weird unease to it, as it's not super crisp, is that blur, and you're not 100% sure what's going on and what the madness is.
Yeah. But you were asking who says this. So Janet Maslin of the New York Times claimed that the film shows no rhyme or reason to it.
What?
Mm. Roger Ebert complained that it was impossible to connect with any of the characters because they're so unlikable.
Really? Huh.
It's also the only Kubrick film ever to not be nominated for an Oscar or a Golden Globe.
I did not know that. Yeah. Huh. Interesting.
Now, a lot of that is behind the scenes. But, like, maybe Warner Brothers did not nominate it for, or have it nominated for anything.
Yeah.
It was nominated for 2 Razzies.
Razzies?
Yeah, the Razzies are this in-joke with people who live in Hollywood who host their own awards ceremony, but it's the worst stuff. So it was up for Worst Director and Worst Actress.
Oh, wow.
The other biggest critic of this film is Stephen King himself.
Yeah.
He famously dislikes this movie.
Okay.
He wrote the script.
Does he still, dislikes it to the day?
Okay. Yeah. He really despises this movie. So...
I mean, there is a lot of stark differences between the movie and the book.
Well, so in the late 90s, I think it was ABC, gave King a budget. I want to say they spent like $30 or $40 million on this miniseries, but it was a script written by Stephen King, and I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's terrible.
I have not seen it.
It hews more closely to the book.
Yeah.
It falls apart because it does things that are in the book on the screen, but they just don't look right.
Yeah. And again, a little bit of a teaser.
Yeah.
When we get to our book report, we're going to compare the movie and the book. Yeah.
Exactly.
More in depth. So we're just going to sort of lightly gloss over or touch the book for right now. But really, we're going to dive into the movie.
Yeah. And then the other thing that he says is that Kubrick has created a memorable image, but it is a poor adaptation. I agree with that.
Yes.
It is a poor adaptation of the book. So if you read the book and watch this movie and expect to see the book, you're not going to see it. They're two different things.
Yeah.
But they're both equally good.
Now, did you see the movie before you read the book, or did you read the book before you saw the movie?
Movie first, then book.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah.
Because I actually read the book for the first time for the Book Report podcast, so...
Okay. The other thing that King says is that it is the only adaptation of his work that he can remember hating. Not Christine and not The Running Man?
Yeah.
Really? Like, those two seem far weaker. Even though I like Arnold Schwarzenegger and I like John Carpenter, neither of those movies... I think this is a much stronger movie than either of those.
You know, and I think this is probably one of the most memorable Stephen King adaptation movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think
Maybe The Green Mile or Shawshank Redemption. Yeah, it... Yeah.
I think that when you ask just a random person on the street, what is a memorable Stephen King remake?
This would probably be top 3.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. It would probably be Shawshank, It, or Shining.
Yeah.
Yeah. And nowadays, The Shining is so... Like, there's so many memorable moments into it. Like, think about it. Ready Player One had a dedicated section for just The Shining.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like that was widely accessible for people who were going into that movie.
Yeah.
And people who were going into that movie were probably of a younger age. Like, yeah, I don't think 30 or 40-year-olds were going into that movie.
Probably not.
Yeah. So people understood and recognized that movie, even if they might have not seen it, just because of all of the famous scenes of, like, the elevator with the blood.
Yeah.
With the axe in the door.
Yeah.
Things along those lines.
Which, you know, it's funny. Everyone apparently were... When with Ready Player One, I remember hearing people seeing it, and they're like, well, this just ruins The Shining for me. The Shining came out, like, almost 40 years ago.
Yeah.
The trailer for the... You mentioned the elevator with blood.
Yeah.
The trailer in the... When this was coming to theaters, was just a narration over a shot of the closed elevator doors.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the narration, they opened up and the blood comes out and it turns the camera red and it goes to black.
Yeah.
Like, it's a fascinating trailer, but it's like, it's so different from the types of trailers we have today.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that is pretty much the last note other than a small comparison that I have with the book.
Yeah.
I think that these two, the two properties are, or two media are distinct in that I kind of feel like King in the book writes more about morals.
Yeah.
And Kubrick, like I said, is more interested in watching characters deal with
madness.
Not necessarily madness, but like what I have here is fates beyond their own control.
So you think
he's more interested in how Jack is manipulated to do horrible things,
yeah,
rather than Jack having the choice to not do those terrible things, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but there is a moment in the movie where he does have multiple chances to choose. Where he has
choice.
Kind of, yeah.
Does he?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, we can dive into that right now. It's,
yeah, let's do.
It's one of the choices is when he's actually at the bar. So, Jack, we're, I guess, assuming that you've seen this movie already.
Yeah.
Or if you haven't, you should probably watch it, then listen to this cast. Just because, again, spoilers, and we're going to kind of be diving into it. So, Jack is an alcoholic. He is an alcoholic.
Recovering. Well, he's a white-knuckling alcoholic, which, yeah, white-knuckling is when you don't go to AA, you just kind of power your way through getting sober.
Yeah.
Which doesn't work necessarily.
Not usually. I'm not sure. In the movie, do they specifically say that he was a teacher at one point, or is that just in the book?
That is just in the book.
Okay.
In the movie, he is,
he's just a writer.
He's just a writer.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So he has the choice when he is at the bar. When the hotel has manifest this bar with actual alcohol in it. And then he starts talking to the previous caretaker, who's pretty much convincing him, hey, you need to deal with this shit and take care of your family. Take care, in quotation marks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where he makes this decision of kind of feeding into this madness where he just allows himself to get sucked into this. And then another part is when they've actually locked him into the freezer.
Yeah.
Where he has the choice of staying in that freezer. I don't think his wife would have left him there. And this is just, you know, my personal opinion. But he sort of, again, negotiates with the ghost of the previous caretaker.
Yeah.
Where the caretaker's like, look at where you are right now. You're locked there. You need to teach your wife and your son a lesson and basically kill them. And I will let you out if you decide to kill them. And he makes that decision of, okay, I will kill them. And so the caretaker lets him out.
See, I feel like what Kubrick is setting up, mm-hmm, in this movie is a space where the house is purposely trying to manipulate the one that's most easily manipulated.
Yeah.
And that's Jack, because I feel like his subconscious obviously is focused on so many different directions.
Yeah, and he's the weakest.
He's the weak. Yeah, exactly. He's the weakest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that it's more about the manipulation rather than Jack having a choice.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, there is manipulation to it, but I do believe that he has a choice. I don't think it's like destiny or, you know,
oh, I'm not saying it's destiny.
Yeah. Or him being tricked. I believe that the hotel actually gives him an option. It does give him a choice, But, again, it's stacking the deck against his favor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, like, it's not in his control mm-hmm. at all. It's not fated, obviously.
Yeah.
Of
course, the deck is stacked against him. The hotel uses all sorts of interesting manipulation and tricks.
Yeah.
Like, supplying him with alcohol and things along those lines.
Yeah.
When they were first going through and doing the tour of the hotel, I believe the manager even points out, well, there's going to be
there's no alcohol here. Like,
and,
it's all...
Yeah. Yeah. And he even makes the comment of, like, oh, that's good. That's excellent.
Yes. That is A-okay.
Yeah. But then, with the hotel trying to manipulate him and get him to do what it wants, it, I guess, manifests basically alcohol there, so he can drink it.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that alcohol was, like, there was actually alcohol, or was it all subconscious? Well, again,
I think it's subconscious. I think the house is manipulating him, because, you remember, like, my takeaway from the movie is, with the, you've always been the caretaker, and, you know, he has photos and things.
At the very end, there's a photo, like, an old...
From 1923 or something. Like, it's a New Year. It's a photo from a New Year's Eve party in the 20s, and Jack Nicholson's character is in a tux in the photo.
Yeah, where it's like, you've always been the caretaker.
Yeah, like, he's... The statement I think that they're making is that he is obviously his soul is now... been consumed by the house,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think it means him specifically as all. I think more along the lines of it being a like, people like you are always the caretaker.
Yeah, like, he's kind of the avatar.
The weak.
Yeah.
Weak, wounded
mm-hmm.
people who can be taken advantage of by the house.
Who can kind of succumb to this particular, temptation.
Yeah. So again, I think it's that the movie is more focused on fates beyond control, and the book is more about morals and making choices.
Yeah, and so the actor who plays Danny, yes. I will say, fantastic kid actor.
So he did not realize he was making a horror movie.
Really?
He didn't find out until he was a teenager, and...
Even with the voice that he was making?
He was just told to make a weird voice.
When
he was cast, his parents took him to a casting session, and the casting director talked with him for a few minutes, and recommended him to Kubrick as the kid. And he's like, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Kubrick took great lengths to... Because at the time that Kubrick is making this movie, he has grown children at this point.
Yeah.
And so he, like, I think he took great lengths in separating the actor that's playing Danny from the movie they were making to avoid any sort of trauma.
Yeah.
Which, again, why I fall in the camp of, even though it's an asshole thing to do, I don't think that Kubrick was deliberately picking on Shelley Duvall. I don't think he was subconsciously picking on her. I think he was doing it for a purpose.
Because
if you're that type of asshole who doesn't care about your actors, you don't go out of your way to separate kids from the horror movie that they're actually making.
Yeah. I did not know that.
The actor,
I think that,
I think he's like a teacher in the Midwest now. Like, I think it's the only movie he's been in.
Wow.
But yeah, he didn't realize it was a horror movie until he was, like, in his teens.
Yeah. Because I will say, some of his scenes really, I don't know if it was just because I was younger, I could sort of relate to those scenes, or I could sort of see myself in that, like, situation, but some of his scenes, especially, you know, with him writing Red Rum on the window, or not the window, the mirror, in his mother's lipstick, and just, like, this imaginary friend where he's talking to him through his finger and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's very creepy. I will say, it's interesting, they don't really go much into the actual Shining ability in this movie.
They
keep it very ambiguous.
Yeah.
Where you're not 100% sure.
Which is really the best way to do it, I think.
Because
as soon as you define it, like, you immediately put limitations on it.
Exactly. Yeah. But in the book, it was interesting because they do kind of define it. They give it this, like, what the power is. And it's interesting. But yeah, I could see for time how you keep it very vague. You keep it very loose. And it just makes it that much more creepier. Because, yeah. Again, the mother has to deal with all of this.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Well, like, towards the end, when the hotel, all the freaky stuff comes up.
Mm-hmm.
Elevator with blood.
Twins.
The twin. Well, yeah. I don't think she ever interacts with the twins. I think that's just Danny.
Okay.
But, you know, there's a scene where she's walking up the staircase, and she's on one of the upper floors, and she sees a man in a bear costume.
Oh, right. Getting fellatio.
Blowing a guy in a tuxedo.
I use the more fancier word.
I mean, he is wearing a tux. I guess it is fancy. And they both look up at her.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
So, that's apparently a reference to a cut storyline from the script.
Oh.
Where Kubrick was going to be implying that Jack was molesting Danny.
Oh.
And that was her realization of it. Because there were a lot of scenes shot where Danny had a stuffed animal that looks like that bear in the costume.
Oh, huh. I didn't know that.
Yeah, going to be a scene, I think, where maybe Jack Torrance was like, hey, look, I found these old clothes or whatever, and like wearing a tux. And so that scene, the reason she reacts that way, I mean, even besides it being just a bizarre, like, we're creepy. The only ones in this house or hotel. Why is there some dude in a bear suit blowing a guy in a tux? Like, those were things that were cut from the movie that were intended. And so that's the look of horror on her face.
Wow. Jeez.
Which is kind of disgusting, but I think it's more powerful not having that storyline because it's like, it comes out of nowhere.
It's very ambiguous. And again, there's a lot of very ambiguous
stuff
in this. Yeah. Where you're not 100% sure what's happening. But that's the great thing about horror is your mind fills in these blanks.
Yeah.
And that's scarier than anything that you can put on the screen is not when your mind starts filling in the blanks because your mind's going to fill it in with the most scariest thing to you.
Yeah.
So, like, what's scary to me might not be scary to Zach.
Yeah.
But we'll still fill in the same blank with our own sort of scary stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it's funny you mentioned that. I was watching Scarface a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever seen that?
I have not, actually.
So, there's a very famous scene where it's the chainsaw interrogation scene.
Okay.
And there are people that swear up and down after screening that movie, they swore up and down that they saw someone get hacked apart with a chainsaw.
Yeah.
You never see it.
Yeah, it's just implied.
It's implied. Huh. You never see, you see the chainsaw and you see a guy hanging up.
Yeah.
But you never see it touch flesh.
Yeah.
You just hear a sound of a chainsaw revving.
Yeah.
And that's it. And then it cuts to something else, but like people swear up and down that no, I saw this guy. And no, you didn't.
Yeah.
You didn't film that. Like, your imagination is very powerful.
Yeah.
It will make something that... And it also depends on how it's cut. I think this movie is cut in such a way...
I think it's fantastic,
Like, you can go on YouTube. There's a hilarious YouTube video where someone has re-edited the footage from this into a fake trailer, pitching The Shining as a romantic comedy directed by Nora Ephron.
A feel-good sort of movie.
Yeah, like a feel-good, like, this is a couple that are about to get a divorce, but they end up not getting a divorce because they have this kid and they go on this vacation or whatever, and it's like, wow, you just change up the music and you can just do anything.
And that's another thing, the music in this...
it's just ethereal synthesizer.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
It gives you that whole, like, sense of dread, that aura of like something's wrong.
Minor keys and synthesizers, baby.
Yeah, and it's it's interesting because I've seen some like scenes this movie, Jaws, where they remove the soundtrack.
Oh, it's not...
And it's not as scary. Yeah, like, the music does a fantastic job of just setting all of these particular, like, scary scenes.
Yeah.
And I think this is why this is one of my favorite movies that Stanley Kubrick has done, is just a lot of things fit in perfectly.
Yeah.
Yeah, to make it such a fantastic movie. The music, the cinematography, just the acting. I mean, we haven't even talked about, like, Jack Nicholson's performance. Like, his face when he busts in. That's such a famous line, famous scene. You can see it still nowadays as even, like, random memes and things along those lines.
Oh, I have seen memes of like, Shelley Duvall, like, horrified, and then, like, something in the place of Jack Nicholson's face in the doorframe.
It's amazing. Yeah. Like, and this movie was made back in,
1980.
Yeah, so over almost 40 years.
God, yeah.
Man.
39.
Jeez. And it's still relevant. Yeah. Like, you know, if you say a particular line or, like, come play with us, Danny, or...
Yeah, forever and ever and ever. Yeah.
People will know what movie you're talking about. And I think that's, you know, a badge of a good movie. Yeah. Something that still stays relevant and is still talked about and can still elicit those same feelings. Like, if I... When I went and saw it at the Fox, like, it was probably, like, 5 years ago... And I still had those same feelings that I had when I was watching it when I was 7.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's just a badge of a good film.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. I hate that this is considered Kubrick's worst film.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, after reading the book, I can kind of understand why Stephen King didn't like it. But in its own rights, by itself, I think it's a fantastic movie.
Yeah, well, and I mean, we'll get into it a little bit more in the book. But, like, going back to the differences in the book and the movie, King, when he wrote it, he was a new father.
Yeah.
I think a new husband. Like, he was just figuring out.
Yeah, I believe this was his third book. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was one that actually went to hardback, and it won a lot of awards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, you know, like I said earlier with Kubrick's treatment of Danny, Kubrick at this point had been married like 30 years.
Yeah.
He had grown children. Like, neither one of them are interested in the same thing. Like, King, I think, was trying to, you know, write about sobriety being broken. Domestic violence is a huge, huge issue in that. Because Kubrick is more about, again, possession and what that does to someone. Because he's not interested in relaying what it's like to be a father or a husband, because he's already been that for 20-30 years.
And again, if you don't know King's background, King also fought through sobriety as well.
Yeah, we'll go into that on
in the book report, which I'm looking forward to. So again, I really enjoyed this movie. Do you want to talk a little bit about Shelley
Duvall?
Yeah.
I think
she did a good, like, her acting, like, I know that she was terrorized on this film. I still think that she did a decent job. Like, I don't think she was all just there for a scared face and screaming. Like, she does give this sort of foil between her and Jack.
I think that she's the weakest point of this movie. I
think it's actually...
I agree with King in that, like, Shelley Duvall does a good... Like, she fits in the movie. Her character does fit. It doesn't stick out as a sore thumb. I feel like... And again, this goes back to what they're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Kubrick needs a foil to how insane Jack Nicholson is portraying Jack Torrance.
Yeah, she is the straight woman.
She's the straight man in the routine.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, where she is, like... your anchor to reality.
Yeah. So Kubrick is using her, like I said, as a foil to pair with, oh, he's being really crazy. He's being insane. Because she's the only other adult, other than Scatman Crothers.
Yeah.
Which I think is
the weakest link, actually.
Oh, you don't like him?
No, I mean, again, now reading the book and seeing what his character actually was supposed to be.
Yeah, that's true.
I feel like it was kind of a waste, and you could have done a little bit more with his character.
Yeah, that's fair. That's probably fair.
Yeah.
But I do think that Wendy Torrance is a much more powerful character in the book.
I agree with you 100%.
Because...
But again, we're not talking about the book. We're talking about the movie.
Yeah, but it's an adaptation of the book. It really isn't.
I think this is where we disagree.
Yeah, well,
that's okay. You know what? It's okay to disagree with people.
Well, I think, like I said, you know, the book is more focused, I think, via King's focus on being a new husband, being a new father, fitting into these family modules, and so she's stronger there because she's an equal.
Yeah, and I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
But this movie is so much different than the book. Yeah,
and that's fair.
And I feel like she is used as that sort of anchor into reality.
Yeah.
Where it's this foil to Jack's insanity.
Yeah.
Where, again, yeah, she is the only adult in the hotel, and she needs to sort of be there to, like, give you a gauge.
Yeah.
And I think she does a fantastic job, given everything that was thrown at her in the movie and dealing with an asshole director.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, she does a great job maintaining and actually seeing the shoot through.
Yeah.
And,
I mean, she ends up not, like, doing too much more, but she does a couple of other roles and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, I guess what I meant by she's my least favorite is that she, I think, does a better performance than King gives her credit for.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't like the way her character is portrayed in the movie is a better way of saying what I think.
And yeah. I agree with you on that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. She does a very good job acting and putting up with an asshole director.
Yeah, and I do think that her character is needed in the film.
Yeah.
But I do... 100% love her character much better in the book.
Yeah.
And I don't think the film does her character's justice via the book, but I think you have to really separate the movie from the book.
Yeah.
Like, the movie is not the book, and I don't think, you know, Stanley was even trying to, you know, hit those themes of the book.
Yeah.
I think, he was doing his own theme, because he was coming from a different perspective.
Yeah.
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 So,
but in total, I really enjoyed this movie.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite movies.
Would you say it's your top 10?
Probably my top 20.
Top 20?
Okay, top fair. 10 of, like, horror thrillers, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah. Like, in general, probably top 20.
I think it's a little bit higher on, I don't know. I've never sat down and made a list of my favorites.
Yeah.
Maybe we can do that for a Halloween episode or something. We can compare notes on horror movies.
Yeah. Well, I know that you probably have a lot more experience and, like, that's your jam.
I love horror movies.
Yeah, yeah. I am probably more of the lighthearted film type.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it'd probably be very interesting to sort of compare and contrast.
To compare and contrast. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, maybe we should do that for Halloween. We'll write that down. But in total, I think that this movie gets an A from me. 2 thumbs up.
Okay, yeah. We'll save grades for books.
Okay.
I mean, I will at least. But it's good to know that you give this movie an A.
Yeah,
I agree. 2 thumbs up. Like, I highly recommend anyone who is interested in watching either a technically proficient film.
Yeah. an interesting storytelling.
Yeah, an interesting horror movie. Yeah. Interesting storytelling. It's got more pros to it, I think, than cons.
Yes.
Just in terms of how it's put together, how it's constructed, structured,
mm-hmm.
And how it's acted, all of the things that make it a movie. It is a shame that it was never nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah.
Because I want to say that the Oscar that won in 1980 for Best Picture was Kramer versus Kramer, which is
really? It's
a Dustin Hoffman movie where he and Meryl Streep are getting divorced and they're fighting over their kid.
I've never seen it at all.
It's not memorable. No. I only know that because I've seen it, but yeah. Like it's generally the story about an overworked father wanting to fight for custody for his kid in a divorce.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I feel like this is a much more powerful, well put together movie than that.
Yeah.
But you know, I also don't vote in the Academy Awards, so.
Well, neither do I.
Yeah. Also, I was negative some amount of years when this movie came out. So.
Yeah. Wasn't even a concept.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, I. Think with that, we'll close out by reminding everyone that we will be at 221 BCon April 5th through 7th and at AtlantaCon May 10th through 12th.
Yeah.
So check out our Facebook page. We've got, I've pinned the post at the top of our convention schedule, so you can always look there and see where we're going to be at.
Yeah.
I've linked their pages so you can find out more of the conventions.
Yeah, you can check out what they're doing, what kind of panels they have. I'm definitely excited.
I'm super excited to see these two shows.
Yeah.
You know, we'll be repeat attendees at 221 BCon.
Yeah,
hands down one of my favorite small shows.
Yeah, but I'm so glad that they let us come back.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I'm definitely looking forward to AtlantaCon.
Yeah.
Just because I was looking at some of their programming from last year, mm-hmm. and it is fascinating. It's the LGBT geek convention.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of interesting panels, and I'm looking forward to our coverage on it.
Yeah, me too. So, we'll be there. You guys can follow us on Facebook. We do a Nerd Fight. We have one going on right now.
Yep.
We normally do Nerd Fight coverage. We've got a couple more interesting things in the works.
Yeah.
Definitely
check us out on Facebook.
Yeah.
See, you know, give us a like and you'll be current on all of our
coverage and things and stuff.
Yeah.
And
again, you know, teasing a little bit about our book report. If you really enjoyed this podcast, you'll definitely love our book report on The Shining.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and that is also the current book club book. So finish it. It'll go up in 2 weeks.
Yep.
And then, yeah, we'll catch you guys later. Just send us an email at backrowsupershow@gmail.com.
Yep. See you guys later.
Bye.